Les colloques du Collège de France.
Okay, so welcome back to the second talk of the morning session. And our next speaker is Hans Kamp from the University of Stuttgart. And the floor is yours.
Thank you. This is going to be... Can you hear me, A? And can you also read this at this size in the back? Thank you. This is going to be a very... First, thank you very much for inviting me. I am a little nervous for a number of reasons that will become clear as I go on. The first is this is going to be a very different talk from the last one, from which I learned an immense amount and also registered an enormous amount of things I will still have to learn. This talk is going to be different for one thing, in that I will not give any kind of overview of a part of the literature. I thought this was my assignment on this occasion, just present one particular way of thinking about, you might call them files for individuals, but in a very specific context, the setting is that of formal semantics for natural languages, the way that project started in the late 60s by Richard Montagu, and that a particular branch of which then developed further into a theory that can deal with various aspects of multi-sentence discourse and texts in a way that was not foreseen in these early works of what is now called Montagu grammar, where the concern is just with the syntax-semantics interface, the getting off a syntactic structure and moving from there to a semantic representation that was part, if you look at it the right way, of what Montagu and his immediate followers wanted to do. What he does was a syntax and semantics for individual sentences of natural languages, just as one can think of the Chomsky project of natural language syntax as in the first instance a project about the syntactic structure of grammatical sentences and not more generally about discourse. So this talk will be about entity representations in the specific sense in which I use that term, and the specific sense of my use of this term has to do with the role that these entity representations, they, by the way, I mean, do what their name says they should be doing, namely represent entities, rather than representing something like propositional contents, something that will also be important in what I'm going to say. But so what the entity representations do and why I've chosen for them the form that I will present and the various versions of form and function that I will say a little bit about in the end, that can only be explained by actually saying something about the framework in which these entity representations have been introduced and where they do the work they are meant to do. So since some of you will be familiar with this framework, it's called MSDRT, a terrible name, but it means Mental State Discourse Representation Theory, and it is an extension of DRT, Discourse Representation Theory, that perhaps a few more of you, perhaps the majority of people in this room, know something about. So in order to say what I want to say about entity representations, I will have to say a little bit about the general structure of MSDIT. And before that, I will say just in a very few words something to recall us all about the basic architecture of DRG. By the way, don't look too much at the text in the slides that you see in front of you. The most important thing is... Well, this will do it too. We're going to... I'm way too far. I know what I did. Sorry, I have a little difficulty with navigating this, but I'll learn as we go on. So, here in one we have two sentence discourses. The one that will play a very important part in this talk is the second. I got this from a free paraphrase of an example discussed by several people, among them Mark Sainsbury, a philosopher and colleague of mine at the University of Texas. The one that's really important is B. Ponce de Leon believed there was a rejuvenating fountain in Florida, and he wanted to find it. And the point about this example is that this is a complex attitude attribution to Ponce de Leon. It's complex in the sense that what is attributed by it is a combination of two propositional attitudes of different kinds, a belief and a desire. And the content specified by the sentence, by the attribution of these two attitudes, actually stand in a certain relation which is conveyed by the anaphoric connection between the pronoun it in the description of the desire and its anaphoric antecedent, the indefinite a rejuvenating fountain in the specification of the belief. We first look at a variant of this, which is in 1A, which is the two-sentence discourse. There is a rejuvenating fountain in Florida. If someone drinks from it, they will become young. It sounds more natural with again, but I leave the again out. In the analysis that we will now briefly present, 1A is a typical example of a donkey discourse. Donkey discourses are like donkey sentences, a problem that was first mentioned by Peter Geech in the book Reference and Generality, of which to which Ellen referred at one point. And donkey sentences have a pronoun in one part of the sentence that refers back to an indefinite in another part. A donkey discourse like 1A is one where the pronoun and the antecedent occur in different sentences. And DRT was developed, among other things, although not originally, in order to deal with this problem, and I'll just show you how it does that. Very quickly, because I think many people know this, just to remind you. So you first build a syntax. I'm not going to say anything much about the syntax or anything at all about the syntax in this talk, but a syntax for the first sentence, and from that sentence by a particular, you might say, translation algorithm, you derive a logical form for that sentence. The logical forms of DRT belong to logical form languages, which are defined independently of the natural language fragments that you study, but of course are attuned to what's in these natural language fragments. And these logical form languages are defined along the lines that are now standard for defining formal languages like the predicate calculus, where you specify the syntax of the language, the set of its well-formed expressions, and then give a model theory in which the logical forms, the well-formed expressions of the language, get appropriate evaluations. So there's a truth definition that relates the logical forms of sentences of the logical form language in particular to models in terms of somewhat simplifying truth and falsity. And you can also put it in saying that the logical forms have in each model a certain denotation. The definition of truth or satisfaction gives you that. So that's it's a basic assumption. And in 2A, you have the logical form that I'm assuming here for the first sentence. It's a discourse representation structure with, at the top, a so-called discourse reference. These were are to be thought of as, in some sense, representing individuals that this discourse talks about. And then below the line, there are various predications, conditions that the represented sentence expresses about the entities that these discourse references at the top represent. So the five such conditions. In particular, that, so to speak, the propositional content of this first sentence, it says about some rejuvenating fountain that it is at the time of this state as one, which holds at the utterance time end, that's what this very first condition means, that at that time there is the state of affairs that consists in the fountain represented by F in the part of the globe, the region represented by the word Florida and the discourse reference thereof. So that, and then I'm not going to go into how the structures of this kind actually get evaluated in models, but let's take that for granted. And then the thing is that when you now turn to the logical form construction of the second sentence, then you can use the logical form you have constructed for the first sentence as a kind of discourse context, which can help you in particular to resolve various elements that we have in the second sentence and that have to do with anaphoric relations between it and the first sentence. So let's see, do I have a guy? The Y and the F are related. The Y is for the pronoun they, and the F is for the someone in the second sentence, and there's a similar anaphoric relation between the it, the Z, and the X is for them.
Sir, you have to use a microphone for the recording.
You can use the mouse.
This one?
No, yours.
Can I? Oh, I see. Okay, sorry. Okay, so this actually is giving a representation of the second sentence. This whole thing is this conditional. If someone brings fruit, then they will be young. This has to be represented by a complex condition. And once I have used this as my context, my discourse context, to resolve these pronouns they and it. This is the Y is for the it, and the Z is for the they. Then I can put the two logical forms with two senses together. I can merge them, and what I get is this. And so the upshot of this is we build in DRT, we can build logical forms for such successions of sentences, but what we end up with is just a single logical form for the two sentences together, and the model theory of DRT is such as to just provide then a denotation for this VR as for the two sensors together without actually saying anything about what the contributions are of the first and of the second sensors to this. That, for many purposes, is actually not good enough. The first major example of this, and I don't know whether it's often discussed under this aspect of it, is the so-called SDRT of Ashton and Lascaridis, in which they actually analyzed discourse relations between sentences and other so-called discourse units, and where the DRSs for these discourse units are represented as arguments of certain discourse relations that are part of the logical form language. But there's actually no particularly good way, I mean, it's not obvious, how to actually do the semantics for these SDRT representations so that at the level of model theory you get a sufficiently finely articulated denotation that keeps the contributions that these different discourse units make apart. So that is one of the reasons why, or it's connected with the reason why, I've skipped this. This is how you handle presupposition in DRT nowadays. Yeah, in MSDRT, so MSDRT was originally developed, as I said, in order to get a handle on these complex attitude attributions, like the attributions of Ponce de Leon of the belief and the desire. And there, too, you want to actually have a sort of abstract characterization of the content of the logical forms that MSDRT offers for attributions like this one to Ponce de Leon. So it's repeated then for A. And where the content of the attributed desire and the content of the attributed belief are somehow kept separate. The intuition behind that being that what you actually say in such an attribution about the attributee is something that sort of gives an angle on what what things are like in their mind, things that might explain why the attributee did certain things in the past, or why she or he may be expected to do certain things. As a result of forms of practical reasoning in which the belief and the desire both play a role, but where the roles that they play clearly are different. The role of the desire is something like a goal, and the role of the belief is some constraint on how you can get to the goal. So here then we have a representation, an MSDRT representation of the first sentence of 4A, just the belief. And here it's worth being a little more detailed than I've been so far. One of the ideas of MSDRT, and it sort of continues with what I've just said about its motivation, is that these complex attributions, and sometimes single attitude attributions too, are most of the time, or often at any rate, meant to give the audience of the attribution an idea of the mental state of the attributee. And so the general approach of MSDRT is to analyze these complex and simple attributions as descriptions of the mental states of the attributees. And these descriptions in the version of MSDRT I'm talking about here take the form of sets of constituents, the these descriptions, MSDs or mental state descriptions, are sets of certain constituents. Among these constituents are representations of propositional attitudes, such as beliefs and desires and doubts and so on. So here, there's just one such object, such constituent, that's the belief. And then in this case, in addition, it's assumed that has to do with the use of the name Florida in the attribution as part of the specification of the belief content. Some of this will become clear as we go on. That is an assumption that MSDIT makes about the use of proper names in such content characterizations of propositional attitudes. The use of such a proper name in such a context is to be understood as attributing to the attributee not just the attitude or attitudes reported, such as the belief here, but also an entity representation for the referent of the name that the attributor uses. So that's how this entity representation at the top of the MSD, the stuff in squirrely brackets there, has made it into the representation, according to MSDIT, of the first sentence of 4A1A. And much of what I'm going to say from now on will have to do with these entity representations, which I'm not quite done with this example. Very briefly, the second C is a representation of the second sentence. It has just the desire in it, but the desire, again, has the result of an anaphoric resolution of the pronoun it in want to find it, and the discourse referent from for the fountain. And then, just as in DIT, we can now merge these two representations for the two sentences into one. And in this particular case, and that has to do with the role of this predicate at that I haven't said anything about yet, we can then actually, turn this merge into one where, in fact, now the two MSDs of the first and the second in C are merged. That has to do with the fact that in this particular case, the desire and the belief are attributed to the same attributee, Ponce Leon, and also at the same time. So that's something in which this process of discourse representation from MSDIT also differs. I should say a little bit more about this predicate at. At is a four-place predicate, and it means basically that this argument here is that the attributee has a mental state of which what's in the second argument, that MSD, is typically a partial description, and then there's something here at the end that a link condition, and that is going to be important later on. I will not say anything about it, but given the link here, that's we actually have for at, strictly speaking, four arguments: the state described by attitude predications, the attributee, the mental state description for the mental state of the attributee, and then this link stuff that I will leave now for the moment. So much for the general architecture of MSDIT. Otherwise, let me just go back, the whole environment of the theory is a rather complicated model theory that is complicated for one thing, because it wants The content of the desire and the content of the belief to be separate, the device that's been used, and I say this without being able to explain it if you don't know this already, it actually makes use of a fundamental notion in dynamic semantics as developed first by Grünendijk and Stockhoff, according to which, and Scott also goes back to Heim, I should say, according to which we actually don't want to talk about propositions. The ontological category of a proposition as a set of possible worlds or perhaps a set of models is no longer adequate according to them. Rather, we want a combination of what they call information states, as a kind of refinement of the notion of a proposition, together with a dynamic notion of a context change potential. So the context change potentials are for those content representations that really depend on other content representations, just in the way that the representation of the desire here depends via this this anaphoric relation on the content of the belief. And so in the model theory of MSDIT, this here is gets as its value in models an information state, and this gets as its value context state potential function from information states to information states. That's actually defined on this information state, and when you apply to the information state, you get another information state, that, so to speak, the content of desire in the context provided by the belief. Okay, so that makes the thing more complicated than I can explain here, but now I want to continue by saying more about these entity representations, of which we have seen a first example of in this treatment of the Ponce-Leon discourse. And what you see here is that this entity representation here for the bit of land or a region referred to by the name Florida is, it consists of three parts. This is just to identify that it is an entity representation rather than some kind of propositional entity representation. Next to it is a discourse reference. A discourse reference of DRT is still around in MSDIT too. In that respect, MSDIT is an extension of DRT. But this is the distinguished discourse reference of the entity representation. It's used elsewhere in the MSDIT. Like here, for instance, to make the predication of which is part, like this one, a predication about the reference of this entity representation. So we should think of this whole thing here as a mental state description, a description of a mental state of the attribute T according to the attribution, in which the content of the belief is about the referent represented by the entity representation. And that's what makes this content singular, a singular proposition in the old way or a singular information state in the new Grünendijk and Stockhoff way, but in the sense that the truth conditions or satisfaction conditions of this are whether the actual referent represented by this entity representation has the properties expressed by those conditions. For this entity representations, one role of entity representations is to make the representations of content, for propositional content in quotation mark, in which the distinguished discourse referent occurs, into propositions or information states that are singular about the referent of the entity representation. So that is only about the first component so far here. The second component is a component that makes room for descriptive information about the represented reference that actually has important connections, but not connections I am able to work out, certainly on the spot at the moment, with many of the things that Ellen has said in her first talk. It's used, for one thing, to include the kind of social information without which it's plausible to say that the attributee wouldn't know what to do with the reference in cognitive processing and practical reasoning in particular. And also it's used for certain kinds of other information, as we'll see later on, for instance, that the reference of the entity representation is known to the agent, to the attributee, under a particular name. That, in certain contexts, is extremely important kind of information about entity representations as they come about in the processing of natural language discourse, and we'll see a little bit of that. How much more time do I have?
You still have 15, 20 minutes.
Sorry, 20?
15 or 20 minutes, after
okay.
20 minutes.
Okay. And then the last component is actually the one that's going to be most important. That has to do with how an entity representation can actually represent something in the real world. The singular contexts that are mediated by entity representations are about things in the world. They are about the things, the entities that are represented by the entity representations. How do entity representations qualify as representations of things in the world? That is by virtue of this third component, which is called the anchor set of the entity representation. And the anchor set consists of anchors. The anchors are testimonies or witnesses at the level of the attributee's psychology, so they're part of the mental state of the attribute, like the whole entity representation is. But they are witnesses to events that provided the causal anchoring of the entity representation to the entity in the world that it then functions as a representation of. So these anchors, these witnesses of such events, differ depending on what kind of events they differ, and there are in particular two kinds that are important for what I'm going to say in the rest of the talk. There are the perceptual anchors. Where are the perceptual anchors? That's a little further. Here. So the other perceptual anchors, those are the witnesses of events in which the agent, until now I talked about attributee in the first argument of that, but now I'll talk about the cognitive agent. The agent that has the ER has observed or has perceived the entity that is represented by the ER. So the typical situation is where you form as an agent a new ER for something that you see at that moment and see it for the first time. And in that case, the ER will have in its anchor set a perceptual anchor that witnesses this perception that you now are involved in, or that maybe has just happened. And later on, it may also be represented as an event that happened much earlier. And if such a perceptual anchor is true, for which there's no guarantee, you might think you perceive something and there's nothing there. But as long as it's true, it provides testimony to the proper anchoring of the ER to the thing you are perceiving. So perceptual anchors are often, but not always, members of the anchor sets of ERs. But in addition, and those are going to be even more important for the rest of what I will be able to say, there are the so-called vicarious anchors. Vicarious anchors are witnesses of events in which somebody other than the agent is making what the agent takes to be a reference to some object in the world by using, for instance, a proper name for that object. And were the agent, even if he's never heard of the name and has no idea of what the reference really is, so he can't recognize this reference that the speaker makes as referring to something of which he has a representation already, in such a case, it is, the claim is now, possible for the agent to form an entity representation for what the speaker has been referring to on the strength of his trust that the speaker actually has made a proper reference to something by the use of her words. This idea that you can actually form entity representations on the basis of that kind of information is certainly not self-evident. It arose in the context of developing MSDIT as part of an attempt to use this framework to explain something about the use of proper names in natural language that was first made explicit by Saul Kripke in his seminal Naming and Necessity, and that's now really part of pretty much every philosopher of language's baggage. It caused within the philosophy of language and mind and logic an absolute revolution. And the basic idea that Kripke had is, you know, how can we explain, if we don't want to say that everybody has his own description, a set of properties associated with a certain name used publicly, and uses that collection of properties or representations whenever he thinks about what is denoted by the name. If you don't want that, that was the view that Kripke wanted to debug, then you need another account of how it comes that names for particular individuals actually become common property within a large part of the speech community. And his story is that, okay, the name gets introduced, take a case of a child that's being baptized and gets a certain name, let's just talk about the first the name of the child. And then other people can pick up the use of this name, say it's Charles, by being present when people who already know the name and what it refers to make use of the name in references. So what I've just been telling you about vicarious anchors models that idea. We can learn about things and their names, and sometimes also about things without actually a name being used, from the way in which other people speak. This is actually a more natural model for how we very often pick up new names and some sense of what they denote or refer to, I should say, from the occurrence of names in text, but it happens also when we attend to what other people are saying in speech. So that is then, so far, the function of these vicarious anchors. They do something very similar to the perceptual anchors. Both make, insofar as, and to the extent that they are witnesses, true witnesses of these causal relation establishing events that I was talking about, the perception and the processing of what somebody else is saying, to make the entity representation into a causally founded representation of what it represents, of the entity that is in the world and that I'll now refer to as the entity representation's reference often. But this vicarious anchors, there is something more. And that has to do with a very important dimension of this, what Kripke actually established through his theory of names, the so-called causal chain theory. And that has to do with a certain, social, intersubjective aspect of the use and the learning of human languages. We learn, so the story goes, the use of a name from somebody else using it, taking for granted that that reference must have had a proper reference, and then take our use of the name from now on sort of as committed to that same reference. And so on the one hand, these vicarious anchors can actually then, according to this story, justify entity representations as properly linked to their reference. But there's also another aspect to them, and that is by my taking over the other speaker's use of a name ensay to form my entity representation for the referent that he has used N to refer to, I also thereby kind of establish a link between me and this other speaker, and not only that, but also a link in particular between the entity of representation I have now created and the entity of representation that I assume, as part of assuming that he used the name properly, that I assume he must have had as a justification for his referential use of the name. So these vicarious anchors have a role to play along two different dimensions. One dimension is the relation to the world. That's what they share with the perceptual anchors. But on the other hand, they also provide, establish links between the entity representations of different people that are connected via acts of reference made by one and interpreted as such by the other. So these links that vicarious anchors establish on this theory between the entity representation I form with the name that you use is new to me, and the entity representation that it's now assumed you also have and that justifies your use of the name, these intersubjective connections between agents and between the entity representations in question, these links can be thought of as creating a kind of dynamic network of entity representations entertained by the members of a speech community. So that actually now opens up the possibility of looking at what these vicarious anchors do as creating such networks of entity representations, and in particular networks of entity representations that are thought by the possessors of these entity representations to refer to the same thing. And the reconstruction within this framework of the Kripke and causal chain theory is now that within such a network, if you take any of the agents that are involved in it, and we think of the networks as giving one entity representation, now this is one of the choices I'm just now making, one entity representation for each of the agents involved in this subset of the speech community. So you can think of the causal theory of the causal change theory of names as saying that anybody within this co-reference network, call him or her A, will have to be connected if she has a proper command of, say, the name Aristotle. There must be within that network a chain going back from A via links established by successive events that caused the introduction of vicarious encus all the way back to someone, or would be more, typically will be more people, whose entity representation of the entity denoted by the name, referred to by the name, actually contained not just vicarious anchors, but also one or more perceptual anchors. Those were the agents that actually encountered the referent Aristotle in person, or who were present at his baptism, if you take the Kripkean story more literally. So the problem now is, A, what can we say about these networks? And I don't have the time to go into that, but there are quite a few structural properties of these networks, as I have sort of outlined their definition, that you can play with, and there is quite a bit of different sorts of structure that tell you something about how we are, say, now able to refer with confidence that we're actually referring to things that go, persons, cities, that go back very far in time. And it also tells us something about the nature of the relation between the possessor of an entity representation and the referent. So there is a distinction that's already made in a paper that by Gareth Evans, The Causal Theory of Names, that appeared very shortly after Kripke formulated his theory, and where he talks about producers of a name and consumers. And I think it's certainly not far from the truth to say that what he really meant by this distinction in the terms of MSDIT that I've just sort of outlined is that the consumers are those whose entity representation labeled by the name and so for the reference of the name only contains vicarious anchors, whereas the producers are those that still are or have been interacting with the referent themselves, and their anchor sets will contain perceptual anchors as well. So there is some context, at least, between this particular distinction within what I've been describing and an issue that goes back to the theory of causal change theory almost at the beginning. The last thing I want to mention is something that goes, also makes use of vicarious anchors. I'll skip this here. And uh, their use in representing information that typically goes back to also to the use of language, and that is the following. One of the original aims of DOT was to develop a way of semantic, a mode of semantic processing resulting in these logical forms that I've been talking about from the very beginning, that actually doesn't make any distinction to whether the utterance or discourse or text that you compute the logical form for is and is understood by the interpreter to be about the real world, to be a kind of documentary use of language on the one hand, and whether it's a piece of fiction or mythology on the other hand. Language, was the idea, functions very much the same way, whether it's a discourse or text of one kind or the other, and that is what the theory should bring out. Now, MSDRT has inherited that pretense from DRT, but now we actually find a new complication when it comes to comparing the logical forms that one forms for a piece of fiction and the logical forms that one forms in interpreting a bit of talk about the real world. And that has to do with the entity representations. When we build a semantic representation for a piece of fiction, now all these individuals that the fiction talks about, Hamlet or Othello or Cassius or whoever, and if it's right that the processing of such discourses proceeds in very much the same way as we process discourses about the real world, then they, that is, these representations of fiction, also should involve the creation, the introduction of entity representations for the various protagonists of the story. But this, of course, is a case where typically the interpreter, the reader of the text, or the person watching the play, or the listener of a story, one knows that there are no entities in the world that are actually denoted by the names that are used in the story. So if we use entity representations also in the construction of logical forms for fictional texts and stories, then there is something in the entity representations I've so far discussed that has to go, and that is the pretends the assumption that they do represent things in the actual world. So that means that I'm also making a further assumption now, but it seems quite plausible, that the entity representations that readers and listeners of fiction construct, that they typically will have, inasmuch as they too, and I think that's right, have anchor sets. These anchor sets will only have vicarious anchors, because these anchors result from taking the author of the story or the mythology to refer to something in some sense. And it's right, also intuitively, that these anchors then establish some kind of intersubjective link with whoever is understood to be the narrator of, or narrators of, the story. So the entity representations that occur in the logical forms of MSDRT for fictional discourse, discourse that is understood as fictional, must be different in certain respects from the entity of representations it for, in logical forms, for real world talk, and they must be different in precisely this way, that the, in quotes, vicarious anchors that make up their anchor sets, that those cannot be the witnesses to acts of true reference. They are witnesses to events of, say, the reader reading a particular passage in which a name occurs for the first time. They are events of the reader saying, okay, I represent this in my representation of the story, and there is a kind of link that is established in this way between the reader's ER and the ER of the storyteller, which, of course, also will not be a real ER, but nevertheless, these two entity representations will be linked by this pseudo vicarious anchor in just the same way, or much the same way, as the entity representations of two people, where one makes a reference and the other picks it up in some way, are linked by the vicarious anchor of the second speaker there. So we need, in other words, also pseudo entity representations. These are the ones that occur in the logical forms that people construct for mythological and fictional texts, and the pseudo vicarious anchors that connect such pseudo ERs with, in the case of fiction, pseudo ERs of others. The narrator on the one hand, and then also other readers and consumers of the text with whom one then subsequently can communicate about protagonists of the story, because now you and they both have entity representations that are for the reference, in quotes, of the names, and that are also linked by some kind of network that comes about through the collective consumption over the years of the piece of fiction. And so the interesting thing now is, further thing is, that actually when you look at discourse that has to do with fiction, you find that there is, in all sorts of ways, typically a mixture of entities that we think of as fictional entities and entities that are not. I mean, the historical novel is one example, but this is actually not even the most prominent one. When we think of an important project for the social study of the social dimension of language learning and language use, and use these networks of ERs that I've talked about for that purpose, then what we actually have to recognize or acknowledge is that these networks, or these co-reference networks, not only contain entity representations of the kind I talked about before, where the actual real-world reference is sort of built in or presupposed, but also these pseudo-ERs, and that makes the whole story quite a bit more complicated, but also more interesting because, as I have been saying, processing what you take to be names and other references to fictional objects and processing entity names and other ways of describing or denoting real individuals or entities seems to work very much in the same way, except for this difference between entity representation and pseudo-entity representation. So what this ends up with is a picture that I can only sort of hope you have got some sense of, on the basis of what I've been saying, of how this social dimension of people learning the language in a process where the learning can't really be separated clearly from the using of the language for purposes of communication. That these networks that contain pseudo ERs as well as ERs might be actually very useful foot in the door for that kind of study. Sorry, this last sentence was not grammatical. I want to, well, not the first, by the way, but to conclude just one example that gives some flavor of what I think is actually a very common thing, and this is a common example. This is a discussion between Mummy, who doesn't believe in Santa, and Johnny, 5-year-old, who does. And Mummy is concerned to just leave Johnny for a little longer in his, she knows, mistaken belief that Santa exists. And so one part of their interactions that are driven by his belief there is Santa exists and her knowledge or belief that he doesn't, but trying not to convey that too clearly to Johnny is where she says Santa is coming tomorrow, and he then says, will he or will Santa bring presents? And here I've just made a sketch, but I hope it's good enough. I mean, that's a comparatively simple representation of the mental state of Mummy and the mental state of Johnny at the time of her utterance. So her mental state that doesn't really change as a consequence of the utterance she makes. She has a pseudo representation for Santa. That's indicated by this minus here. So when you want to distinguish, one way of doing it, between real entity representations and pseudo entity representations, you can do that by having a fourth component, which can be a minus for a pseudo entity representation, a plus for a real entity representation is just notation, but of course the real problem arises in doing the model theory for all this. And so she has this pseudo entity representation for this individual called Santa. Here we have such a name condition as part of the second component of the ER. And this anchor set is not spelled out here, but it will have to consist. And it will have had to be this way from the time that Mummy actually abandoned the idea that Santa existed, if she ever had it. This will consist only of pseudo vicarious anchors. Only those anchors that do nothing more than produce links between her and other people using, presumably the name Santa, or some variant like he is anaphorically Santa in the example. And that's it. And Johnny, on the other hand, he has a real entity representation for Santa. It's a wrong one. It's defective because there is no Santa, but he doesn't know that. So he handles his entity representation for Santa as a representation of a real thing. And he can then, if he believes what Mummy says, represent the belief on the basis of this entity representation as I made a mistake here in copying. Here, this should be the distinguished discourse reference of this entity representation that Johnny has, so there should be a J here. So that is his representation of what Mummy says. And in addition, I have not noticed that his anchor set, which will consist of A, true anchor representations, but of course they're all wrong, and B, presumably also quite a few perceptual vicarious anchors, which are all wrong because there is no connection to a true reference to Santa, and also some perceptual anchors, but they're equally wrong because these would be safest anchors reporting events where you saw somebody dressed up as Santa in the street and thought it was Santa. So, in a way, these entity representations of Johnny and Mummy are really quite substantially different. But at the same time, communication between them about Santa is basically unproblematic. And certainly, so long as the mother doesn't say anything that sort of forces the son to really change tax altogether by abandoning his beliefs that Santa exists. And I've gone on for too long, but that's the end. Thank you.
So, we have about 6 minutes for questions, so keep your questions short. And keep your... So, Joseph first.
Well, thank you. And
is that working?
I can hear you.
When you mentioned perceptual anchors at the beginning, you said that important, they create the causal link between the representation and the represented object.
The event.
So this is a sort of causal theory of representation. And I thought mental files theory gives us another necessary element, namely tracking the object over or the referent over time. Because you, as a carrier of properties, and you can't have objects without a temporal persistence. Otherwise, it's an empty concept. So wouldn't that be the ability to track also be a necessary feature of being a representation? And that also maybe become a very important for tracking non-existing objects.
This actually touches a point, thank you, on an aspect of the whole thing that I didn't say anything about. This touches on something that I didn't say anything about, but that also does play an important role in the theory, and where indeed I very much need the kinds of help from people like you and Alan and other people who have actually tried to figure out what is involved in agents recognizing something that they encountered before. So recognition and the use of entity representations in this theory in recognition is a very important part. That's how these anchor sets of entity representations will actually grow over time, and the growing itself is also a problem that one should say something about, but leaving that aside, so these entity representations are thought to be elements of the mental states of agents that, after they have been formed, then continue to be there and play this sort of central role in cases of recognition when they take place, which is sort of somehow activating that entity representation and then adding to its anchor set a witness to the event of now seeing the entity again, or seeing it or understanding it as referred to by somebody else. So exactly what goes on in any of those cases, I've not said anything about here, but I also have so far in what I've been doing said very little about. And this is precisely one of the links, I would say, between what I'm trying to do and all this work within cognitive psychology that I haven't worked up sufficiently, and I'm already feeling I'm learning quite a bit that I might be able to use from this conference. And tracking is, of course, yet it's not exactly the same. It's not sort of getting this entity representation that you formed at an earlier time that went dormant, activating it again in your event of seeing this individual that you now recognize. But it's also something that the theory that I've been outlining doesn't have anything of significance to say about. So far.
So this is, I'm afraid, a very foundational question.
Yeah.
So we're trying to understand what's going on when people are keeping track of information during a discourse, kind of individual type information, and how that's coordinated between two speakers. And you were emphasizing the similarity between the fictional case and the real case and the kind of fluency. But nevertheless, you're introducing a component, this difference between pseudo-anchors and real anchors that the user has to keep track of without making an error. I wonder whether these cases suggest we should do something much more radical and think that what's going on in coordinating in discourse or keeping track individually in discourse doesn't involve anchoring, that you've put something into the machinery that ought not to be there if we're understanding what people are doing in keeping track of individual type things in discourse.
Yeah, it might well be that if one were to build in more about how people recognize things that they have encountered on previous occasions, that then what you actually need by additional components of the cognizing mind might make this whole talk about anchors that may or may not be in the agent's conscience at any particular time. And it's another distinction that he didn't actually say anything about. It might well be that at that point, this talk about anchor sites and the anchors they contain becomes superfluous, becomes replaced by the sort of thing that I think you were referring to. And yeah, I have nothing that I can say that would justify my feeling that even then you can use these anchors at some level of abstraction to describe what is going on in cognition and recognition and misrecognition. So again, this is not a particularly satisfactory answer. It's only to say that this was all developed in order to deal with certain problems within the philosophy of language and logic. And the tools that have been developed were developed for the specific purposes of dealing with these questions. If you look more closely at how cognition works in the way that cognitive scientists can, and I cannot, then it might well be that this is what I have been talking about is a level of description that gets replaced by something more detailed and better.
I'm here. Hi.
Sorry.
No. So, as you've been talking, I thought that this framework is really set up so to capture cases of intentional identity or Hobnob cases in particular. But as we got to the anchoring, I realized that I feel like there are multiple ways to cash out those type of situations, and I wasn't entirely sure what exactly identity between pseudo entities would mean at all, or how exactly does that work. So, if there are pseudo entities with pseudo anchors, what does it even mean for them to be the same or different in a way?
I don't know whether this would be the best way to answer that question, but it's a very good question. So as far as, I think you actually mentioned Hobnob cases also, so intentional identity cases, as I sometimes formulate it, were somebody who doesn't believe in witches goes to a community where they do and then can talk about, say, about two members of that community, Hob and Nob, that I mean, perhaps everybody knows this, but Hobbes thinks that a witch killed Cobb's cow, and Nob thinks that she blighted Fred's horse or something, were the she is anaphoric to the A witch in the first attribution to Hobbes. And so there's a kind of relationship between the descriptions of the beliefs of these two individuals, and how do you explain why this is actually quite an appropriate way of describing what the journalists found in that community. And so here we actually need something more than anything that I've talked about. Here what we need is, very roughly speaking, something like a network that involves not only Hobnob and perhaps other members of the community, but also the speaker of this attribution. And then the question, so the speaker has a pseudo representation for the witch that these people, presumably is only one story, have talked to him about. And at the same time, he takes them, including Hobbes and Nob, to have entity representations for this witch. And there's a further question whether it's the same witch that Hobbes and Nob have an entity representation for or not. But if the journalist actually phrases his Hobbes and Nob sentence in the way it's done in the example, then the she in the specification of the belief of Nob actually suggests very much that he, the journalist, takes these entity representations for these witch entity representations that Hobb and Nob have to be part of the same entity representation networks, at least for within that community. And other cases are not quite like that, but they should be analyzed, I would propose, along this line, at least within this theory.
Okay, so it's already 1 p.m., so apologies for my last question. I can ask a question during the break. So thank you very much for your talk. And
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.